This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, blowback throughout the Middle East with protests against United States diplomatic installations in Cairo, Egypt, and in Benghazi, Libya. We'll be looking at what happened and why as we speak with a former United States diplomatic official, as well as a Mideast scholar about what has happened after the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya and the possible relationship of an anti-Islamic film. All of that and more coming up on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And overnight, there were dramatic developments at two capitals on the northern tip of Africa, in the nation of Egypt and in the nation of Libya. In Egypt, protesters took over the United States embassy that had been largely evacuated in Cairo in protest of the recent Arabic translation of an Islamophobic film called Innocence of Muslims. And also overnight in Benghazi, the United States Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens and Sean Smith, a computer expert on information systems for the State Department, along with two United States Marines, were killed when they came under attack by rocket-propelled grenades and other kinds of gunfire as they attempted to flee the United States consulate in Benghazi. The events that took place in Libya appear to have been coordinated by a militia of uncertain identity at this time, but we'll delve into that in the course of today's program. Also, there was the publication of the film that was also promoted by Terry Jones, the provocateur religionist who earlier had threatened to burn the Quran. And now there seems to be turmoil throughout the Middle East. In Tunisia and other places, there are similar public demonstrations. In today's program, we shall seek to find out to what extent it is the film which negatively depicts the Prophet Muhammad as a pederast, a pedophile, a philanderer, and a wanton killer. So we begin with the statement made just a short time ago today by President Barack Obama about the events in Cairo and in Benghazi.
Good morning. Every day, all across the world, American diplomats and civilians work tirelessly to advance the interests and values of our nation. Often, they are away from their families. Sometimes, they brave great danger. Yesterday, four of these extraordinary Americans were killed in an attack on our diplomatic post in Benghazi. Among those killed was our ambassador, Chris Stevens, as well as Foreign Service Officer Sean Smith. We are still notifying the families of the others who were killed. And today, the American people stand united in holding the families of the four Americans in our thoughts and in our prayers. The United States condemns in the strongest terms this outrageous and shocking attack. We're working with the government of Libya to secure our diplomats. I've also directed my administration to increase our security at diplomatic posts around the world. And make no mistake, we will work with the Libyan government to bring to justice the killers who attacked our people. Since our founding, the United States has been a nation that respects all faiths. We reject all efforts to denigrate the religious beliefs of others. But there is absolutely no justification to this type of senseless violence. None. The world must stand together to unequivocally reject these brutal acts.
And that President Barack Obama speaking earlier on the events that occurred at the United States Embassy and Consulate in Cairo and Benghazi, Libya, respectively. We are now joined live by His Excellency Ambassador Edward Peck, who has served in Egypt and Tunisia, as well as Iraq and Mauritania. And he is also the former Deputy Director of the Cabinet Task Force on Terrorism during the administration of President Ronald Reagan. And I welcome you back, Your Excellency, to 5 o'clock Shadow on this troubling day.
It's a pleasure, sir.
Well, I would imagine the loss of a peer, a colleague. I do not know if you ever worked directly with J. Christopher Stevens, but first of all, what is your reaction to what happened overnight in both Cairo and Benghazi?
I guess my in addition to the anger and regret and the sorrow and all of those emotions which sweep over you when something like this happens, it could be, and I hope that it is not, it could be the start of a series of manifestations in which people indicate to America in the only way they know how that they're not happy with some of our policies. And I think that this the story about this video that does not dignify Muhammad, the prophet, is just a small bump on a road which has been kind of rocky for us in that part of the world for some 12 years now. And I think that what you see there are two examples of quite different incidents.
The film is being reported by most media as being the proximate cause of the flag ripping in Cairo and of the assault that took place in Benghazi. Yet you seem to suggest that these are qualitatively different incidents.
Well, it's very difficult to say for sure, but one of them, the mob at the American embassy was a demonstration. It became a little nasty in various ways, but it was certainly not extensively different than our own Occupy Wall Street. The people came out, the Egyptian people came out to let anybody who was interested know that they were not happy with this particular manifestation of anti-Islam, I guess you'd have to call it. But in Benghazi, what you had there was an attack, an assault. It wasn't a bunch of people, you know, storming the building. As I understand it, it was some rocket-propelled grenades fired at the building from a distance, and that was an attack, pure and simple. There was no message being delivered necessarily about we're unhappy about this or that particular aspect of your policies or actions. It was just an attack. Similar in its way to the sorts of things that have been going on in that part of the world now for over a decade, some of them involving, you know, what the U.S. does.
There are on-the-scene reports from some people who claim that a heavily armed militia that some people are speculating may have been associated with Ansar al-Sharia, the proponents of Sharia law, that came and usurped the perimeter that was held by the other militias that purport to be an arm of the cobbled-together so-called government in Libya today. Now, this is something that is intriguing because this is not the first assault on the United States consulate in Benghazi. In June, there was an assault when the United States claimed to have killed the Libyan so-called second-in-command of al-Qaeda. And it just so happens that overnight, the Mr. Zawahiri, the nominal head of so-called al-Qaeda, acknowledged after some time that indeed the Libyan member of al-Qaeda had indeed been killed in a United States drone attack in Pakistan. Do you consider any possibility that this might have been a swift and pointed response to United States policy in that part of the world?
Well, Yeah, and it's a difficult thing to think about or talk about, but it isn't as if the United States is not active in that part of the world, and some of our activities are not terribly popular nor accepted by the people who live there as a God-given right, not to bring religion into it again. But we have been involved in the Middle East extensively, especially since 9/11, which itself has been described by the people who are more informed on this issue than I am, that was a reflection of discontent, hatred, call it what you like, of our policies in the Middle East, in particular those policies which are considered to be directed against Muslims and Arabs. So yeah, it would not surprise me. Americans do not pay as much attention to what goes on over there as I think they should, except when there's some horror like this one perpetrated. But the standard day-to-day assaults that we carry out do leave an awful lot of people angry with us, and worse.
I am taken, Your Excellency, by the contrast in defensive behavior in regard to attacks on United States institutions, particularly in Libya. In the year 2006, on the occasion of the publication of the Danish cartoon that depicted the Prophet Muhammad in a turban with a bomb embedded in it, there were protests around the world over what many felt was that offensive publication. And yet in Libya, under the leadership of Muammar Gaddafi and the Jamahiriya at that time, there was not permitted or sustained an assault on United States diplomatic facilities, as has occurred at this time. Is it possible that the removal, the NATO bombing, the United States clandestine operations in the overthrow of the Muammar Gaddafi government in Libya, that it had some stability that has now opened up a Pandora's box of reckless militias of all stripes that are now unable to even coordinate in terms of national security?
Well, yes, is the short answer to that thoughtful question. The United States has been criticized and has been self-critical of the fact that in many parts of the world, especially Latin America, we wound up, if not supporting, at least tolerating fairly dictatorial governments because we were searching for stability. Now, stability is not a dirty word, especially if you consider that in a nation, in any nation, unless there is stability, nothing good can happen. You've got to have stability for progress economically, politically, culturally, socially, because if the bullets are flying, the people are worrying about other things than advancing the society and the culture. So when you topple a government, especially when it's done the way we did it, we helped to have it happen in Libya or in Iraq, you unleash, and I don't use that in a negative sense, you unleash all of the people who've been crouching in the corner, you know, waiting for an opportunity to express their views and advance their interests. And in so many countries in the world, you get these widely divergent groups divided by tribal lines, ethnic lines, you name whatever you want, or just politically oriented, that will step out of the shadows and begin to make efforts to change things their way. Certainly we've seen that in Iraq. I can remember in my own diplomatic career how so many people in America and elsewhere waited for Marshal Tito to finally disappear so that Yugoslavia could flower and prosper. Yeah, well, that isn't exactly what happened when you pulled the cork out of that constructed country, which had all these different divergent groups in it. And the same thing appears to be taking place now, early stages, in Syria. I was there just a year ago last month in Damascus, observing the situation. Once you unleash these forces, it is difficult to stop them if there is no longer any force, let's use that in a non-pejorative manner, any force to keep things organized and in control and disciplined. We see that in Libya. Gaddafi was in power for decades, and when you take him out the way he was taken out with our involvement, a lot of people were not happy with that, not seeing it as something that is our right and responsibility.
Is it possible that the other interest of American diplomacy, and that is the maintenance of the common will and the commercial, that the expeditious renewal and creation of oil contracts may have been considered a compensation for the chaos?
Well, now you're into geopolitics. Well, it's hard to say. You know, the American government, which is supposed to be a government which reflects the will and desire and needs of the people of the United States, has a great opportunity to do things in the Middle East which are decided on reasons and for rationale which has little to do with the will of the people, because the Americans don't pay a great deal of attention, as much as they should, I think, to the realities out there, being far more content with little sound bites and comments from people who are, you know, considered to be knowledgeable or at least have a large audience, which is not necessarily the same thing. And they don't really understand at all, nor do they have any, do they feel any strong need to understand how the people in that part of the world view us. Now, this is important. It should be so easy to understand for people who live in a capitalist society such as ours, because if you want to sell a product, whether it's democracy or the American way, or you pick the word that you want to use, you have to spend a little bit of time trying to understand how the potential customer sees it. Because if you don't, if you're going to ignore the fact that they may not like it or want it or think it's too expensive, you're going to have a very hard time selling that product, and people are not going to like you or what you're trying to sell.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we have the great honor of His Excellency Ambassador Edward Peck speaking with us live today. He served in Tunisia and Egypt, as well as Iraq and Mauritania, and recently visited Syria. And we've been talking, Mr. Peck, about the unleashing through United States subversion of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, and al-Qaeda in general. And having served in Cairo, I'd like to ask if you see any contrast about the transition that has recently taken place there, if indeed it is, with the nominal presidency of Mr. Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood, but still a strong military backstop in the operations of the government. As someone who has been on scene in Cairo, what is your assessment on that side of the day's events?
Well, the Egyptians are different in so many ways from many of the other countries in the area, because their history goes back so far. The parallel would be the Persians, you know, who have a recorded history that goes back for thousands of years, the Egyptians as well, and have more of a national sense, I think, than Libya, which was cobbled together when the colonialism collapsed and the Italians pulled out, having drawn lines in the sand, which made borders. You find, you know, that's what happens in when the colonists take over, so that it's difficult to make the point that very few people are aware that when France took over the League of Nations mandate and was in charge of Syria after World War I, they were the ones who sliced off part of Syria and called it Lebanon, which would explain why Syrians see Lebanon differently than we do, because it used to be part of their country. The same situation applies to Kuwait, which was part of Iraq. This is the sort of thing they don't teach us much in our schools. But Libya has these tribes that lived in the desert, semi-desert, for centuries, and were placed into one country together. And as we know from our own history, tribalism, whatever it's based on, it tends to be fractious in trying to get people to work together. And if they're held in line by a strong central government, or what passes for a government, that's a different situation from when that government is gone, especially if it goes with the involvement of foreigners. I would have a very hard time thinking of countries, nations, that have welcomed an invasion, whether it's an actual physical invasion or the insertion of foreign power through the overthrow of an existing government.
Which brings us to my penultimate question for you, the announcement today that a contingent of United States Marines is now on its way to put boots on the ground in Benghazi and perhaps elsewhere, perhaps Tripoli as well. And we understand that the diplomatic offices of the United States abroad have several layers of protection. There is a State Department Security Service, if I understand correctly. There are privateers or private contractors that may be involved as well as the Marines, whose mandate is to protect inside the perimeter of the wall of the embassy. And yet one cannot help but wonder whether the arrival of United States military personnel, even if they're for diplomatic duty, might exacerbate things. And I guess ultimately, do you find that as, beyond being perhaps a necessary response, a problematic one? And where would you advise us to keep looking for the next hotspots? Because this may spread.
But, you know, let me come to your question by backing off just a couple of steps. A few years ago, the Americans built an embassy in Baghdad, which was announced as costing $1 billion. And I was on a program with BBC, and they said, you know, what is your thought about this $1 billion embassy? And I said, well, you'll excuse me, but it's not an embassy if the people who work in it can't go out into the street, and if nobody who's outside the embassy can come in to talk to the people there. If everybody inside the building is crouched down behind the blast walls and the barbed wire, how in the hell are they supposed to do anything that resembles the normal diplomatic function of an embassy? In Baghdad, you go out with armored cars and helicopters overhead and all of that, and how do you find out what the people are thinking, what they're doing, what they want? You don't. You don't socialize with them. They don't socialize with you. So that the presence of the Marines, you know, we have Marine guards in embassies all around the world, and their job is only to provide security inside the walls. That's understood. And so if you're going to beef up embassies around the world to protect them from the wrath of the people with whom they are supposed to be interacting, then you've done an awful lot of damage to the work, or put an awful lot of impediments in the path of those who are supposed to be representing the country and reporting back to Washington how the people of that country feel about this issue and that issue. It makes it virtually impossible. And for the next hotspots, you know, I wouldn't even make a guess. We have done so many things in so many places that have left people distressed with us that it's awfully hard to guess where the next incident could take place.
Well, I know that you have many commitments today. We are speaking with Ambassador Edward Peck, who has served in Egypt and Cairo, as well as in Tunisia, Mauritania, Iraq, and elsewhere in the diplomatic corps. We thank you so much for bringing us inside insight, and I leave the last word for any comment you might wish to add.
Oh, Mr. Knight, it's a pleasure. You know, talking with and to Americans, passing through people like yourself who are endeavoring to give them information, I consider it a privilege and an honor. And in expressing my views, as you are well aware, I do not represent the United States government, but I did spend a lot of time trying to learn about and understand the people who live out in what we call, I call the Middle East. We are not doing well, and I am fearful that there's a lot of bad things to come, and I hope I'm wrong. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Your Honor, Your Excellency.
Thank you, sir.
Well, you're a good judge, as well as a great ambassador, retired Ambassador Edward L. Peck. And this is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. My name is Robert Knight, and just to recap on some of the major developments overnight, the seizing of two United States diplomatic facilities, the embassy in Cairo, as angry crowds protested the recent Arabic translation of a hit film on the Prophet Muhammad that was produced by an Israeli-American man by the name of Sam Basile. It is a plotting and obvious and hateful work that portrays Muhammad as a pederast, a homosexual, a rapist, and a murderer, and a sadist. And the film has been available on digital media for quite some time, some number of months, but it is only recently that some extreme Coptics in the United States provided an Arabic translation, and that got fed around the world. And just over the past few days in Egypt, it was very much a topic of television and other kinds of programming there, leading to the culmination on this 11th of September that resulted in an odd anniversary of the seizure of the Cairo embassy and an all-out assault by militias as yet incompletely identified in Benghazi, resulting in the death of a computer technical specialist at the United States Embassy, Sean Smith, and the ambassador, J. Christopher Stevens. He was known to have been very much a part of the liaison with the so-called rebels during the United States' involvement in the overthrow of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya and Muammar Gaddafi. And we now delve deeper into these events. We're very happy to have with us Professor Jennifer Lowenstein, the Associate Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And Jennifer, welcome back, and what a day this is.
Yes, indeed. I was very shocked to wake up to the news, and shocked because, of course, it's always shocking to hear that somebody has been killed in a political attack, but not shocked to hear the reason why.
Well, here is an interesting puzzle. Because certainly the emotions and pride and commitment to a belief system of Islam, no matter what variety, certainly insult and outrage is an understandable or a predictable outcome of the media insult that was represented by this Israeli-American-made film called Innocence of Muslims. But I was speaking with Ambassador Ed Peck just a little while ago. And there is another odd item that occurred, and that is the so-called Al-Qaeda leader, Zawahiri, just released a video over the past 48 hours acknowledging the claim that was made in June that the Obama administration had killed the tactician of Al-Qaeda by the name of Abu Yahya al-Libi. And that by a drone strike in Pakistan. So one cannot help but wonder whether there is more than one motive in the heavy military attack on the Benghazi compound. And I open the floor for you to just take your time and analyze these things for
well,
us.
Well, I wish that I'd heard the first half. Unfortunately, I didn't. But listening to what you just described, only it for me, it just intensifies a situation that was entirely preventable, but that was, as usual, as is typical for the U.S. and the U.S. media, not prevented because of a series of, I believe, a series of omissions of things that are not being done. It should come as no surprise that this kind of an attack would happen. That's the first thing I said. But looking at the political events and the political quagmire that the United States has gotten itself into in the Middle East and beyond, in the Muslim world, it surprises me, quite frankly, that there aren't more attacks. It surprises me daily that there aren't more extremists, because the situation in so many places has become so abysmal as a result of U.S. policies. And if I don't know what kind of intelligence it takes to make people, especially people at the top, understand that when you destroy parts of another person's country, when you insult repeatedly other people's cultures, their language, their religion, their rituals, whatever it may be, this is going to have repercussions. The Americans have been unpopular in the Middle East now since, you know, it's been almost half a century. It didn't start out that we were negatively portrayed. In fact, early on in the 20th century, the Americans were looked upon as the good guys because they had not been the colonizers that France and Britain had been. But no sooner did the Second World War end and the British Empire collapsed and the French Empire collapsed over time with a lot of violence, then the Americans are in the Middle East doing exactly the same kinds of things that their predecessors did. They didn't learn at all. And I wonder if they attempted to learn. What I wonder even more is whether they considered attempting to learn. And the reason I say that is because I think there is still a very deeply held, possibly a subconscious belief that the people over there are somehow less intelligent, less superior, less human than the rest of us. And I'm sorry to say, it does look that way to me. It looks that way. It looks, in other words, to me as though there is still a very Euro and Western-centric view, assumption that we carry around with us each day, where we may have interactions with Muslims or Arabs on a daily basis, but somehow we separate individual persons from the groups. And so this kind of I think of it as bullying, this kind of patronizing racist attitude. It's taken hold, and it is controlling much of what we do politically, I believe.
Well, the thing is that arrogance is often based on either fear or, more often perhaps, ignorance.
Yeah.
And there is a blowback that comes from that. Now, over the past several months, the Obama administration has, and the State Department and NATO, have unleashed the Islamicist ambitions of groups in Libya like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, and so many other branches, as well as the Muslim Brotherhood, which now has a nominal president in Egypt. But in Libya, Al-Qaeda has been renewed. And I'd like for you to listen to about 40 seconds of President Barack Obama's preposterous claim of having put an end to Al-Qaeda. And we'll be back right after that.
Sure.
You know, in a world of new threats and new challenges, you can choose leadership that has been tested and proven. 4 years ago, I promised to end the war in Iraq. We did. I promised to refocus on the terrorists who actually attacked us on 9/11, and we have. We've blunted the Taliban's momentum in Afghanistan, and in 2014, our longest war will be over. A new tower rises above the New York skyline. Al-Qaeda is on the path to defeat, and Osama bin Laden is dead.
President Barack Obama at the Democratic Party National Convention. Now, Jennifer Lowenstein of the University of Wisconsin and Madison Middle East Studies Program, are we witnessing in this kind of behavior a form of diplomatic insanity on the part of the Obama administration and the Republicans who love his petroleum policies that are executed even at the risk of chaos and blowback?
Well, my own belief is that the American administration's successive presidential administrations have been exhibiting political insanity in their foreign policy for a lot longer than the last decade. one glance at our record in the Middle East, whether it is toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, toward Iran, toward the Sunni-Shia divide, the fault lines, whether it's in Afghanistan. You know, I don't see any kind of thoughtful, reflective, even I don't even see the grains or the seeds of a policy that has good intentions, but that ultimately is a failure. What I see are insane policies being put forward again and again and again, a kind of willed blindness, a denial of what it is we're doing. And once again, I have to emphasize, whether it's ignorance, whether it's anything else, the attitude in this country, generally speaking, is one of, I believe, racism. I think we have a deeply racist view about brown people, about people who are different than we are, and that more than that, I think it is the Arabs and the Muslims of the world who are getting the brunt of this because of our so-called strategic interests in the Middle East. In other words, I don't think we view Latinos with much better, with much kinder eyes. It's just that we're focused on Muslims and Arabs because it's there in that world, in those lands, that what we want exists. Even if it's just what we, even if what we want is just a matter of control.
We're speaking with Jennifer Lowenstein, Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program in Madison at the University of Wisconsin. And finally, Jennifer, the fact that there has been a bipartisan continuity of this, as it were, diplomatic insanity and petroleum-seeking policy, what is it that might be done in the face of scrambling presidential and congressional candidates uttering the most absurd Americanist hubris about yes. the consequences of these policies? How can American people of goodwill be educated into a consciousness that can change this tandem game that is played by Democrats and Republicans around the world?
Well, sadly, we need an education. We desperately need to be educated about this part of the world and about foreign policy in general and resources, national interests, etc. We need to be entirely re-educated. In other words, first we have to be, what we have learned as a culture has to be wiped clean. What I'm getting at is that it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be a fast process in which Americans slowly come to realize that they are no better than the people that they are targeting, no more deserving, no more entitled, no more somehow worthy as humans or to control lands that are far away from ours. That's, I suppose, irrelevant. Even lands close by don't deserve to be treated with the kind of hubris that you just described. But educating people takes a lot of time and a lot of patience, and it is very difficult to educate people who have grown up with a certain mythology already. Since they were in grade school, they are indoctrinated by our media. They have look at our Democratic National Convention just a couple of weeks ago when the Democrats had to include this clause about Jerusalem being the eternal, undivided capital of Israel.
As well as the theocratic phraseology saying this is a God-given country.
Well, and then I go into my class And I present my class with a blank map of the Middle East, and I have to ask them to name what country I point to and name the capital of that country. And when we get to Israel, 95% of my students say Jerusalem. And when I say Jerusalem is not the capital of Israel, it cannot be the capital of Israel because it is illegally annexed, and it was illegally occupied and then annexed as territory to the state of Israel, and that this has never been recognized by the international community. These are the kinds of things that I find, you want to bang your head against a wall for a little while trying to figure out how we're going to re-educate people to understand what's wrong. Because there are a lot of very curious, innocent, curious, well-intentioned students and others who really want to understand. They want to understand why X and Y and Z are taking place. Why has this happened? Why would anyone want to bomb the World Trade Center? I mean, people really want to know. I mean, there are many people who really want to know. And when they go to their bookstores or their news channels or their newspapers, most of them, first of all, don't know what to look for, what to listen for. And it just becomes more confusing to them to find something that states what is diametrically opposed to what is the accepted or received wisdom. I hope I'm making that clear. We are so far away from educating the American public about Islam, about Arab culture, Arab history, and about what kind of values the United States has really projected overseas. What kind of values are we showing? We're showing values like greed, selfishness, the need for control, the need for dominance. These are the values, if they can be called that, that the Americans are showing the rest of the world in their behavior and activities in countries like Iraq and around the issue of Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan. And, you know, when people see this, if people could be made aware that, no, the oil in Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Kuwait, wherever it is, no, it doesn't belong to us. We don't have a natural right to it. It's somebody else's. It's in somebody else's backyard. I don't think most people ever, for 2 seconds, think about that. Wait a minute. Why do we get this oil?
Eminent domain.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's part of the argument. But if you ask a group of students, as I've often done, I will ask, you know, what right do we have to the oil of Iraq? It's not that I get weird answers or bad answers or ignorant comments. It's that I get blank stares. People who've never even considered that it wasn't rightfully ours.
That is quite a mission, and you have always been one of the educators with each of your appearances here, and we commend your work, not only with your grace here today on 5 O'Clock Shadow, but at the Middle East Studies Program at Wisconsin University in Madison. Jennifer Lowenstein is the Associate Director thereof. And Jennifer, where can people find your work and be less subjected to these eruptions that blow back from our ignorance and arrogance?
Many, many places for people to go, many different websites, and it's hard for me to say one is the best of all. My recommendation to listeners is to read a whole array of different papers. I know that people don't have time to sit down and read 10 papers in the morning. I'm not suggesting that. But I think skimming headlines, it's so easy to do online. Skimming headlines of major papers, some of them very decent. For example, the Financial Times has very good reporting on the Middle East in general. You can find decent reporting sometimes in the New York Times. You can at least find where the pulse of the nation is. You can at least find out what we're up to. You can go to any Middle Eastern country and find an English language paper.
Well, thank you for the advice on that. And we want to stay in touch with you as this development, because I have a feeling we've not seen the end of this story. But we thank you today, Jennifer Lowenstein.
I think we're seeing another beginning.
Well, let's hope the ending of this beginning will be better than the beginning of this end.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. Today's program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced with Thiago Barroso. If you have tips, comments, leaks, questions, or suggestions for 5 O'Clock Shadow, drop us an email at theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.